Welcome to today's Matter seminar. So today we have Jonas, I don't know how
Russo Hatzakis.
Yeah. So he works on a bunch of interesting condensed matter problems, like frustrated magnets, quantum spin ice, something like that, right? So today he will, I think he will talk about something very interesting. So,
yeah. So, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's my first time in this institute. Thanks for the invitation. And I'm going to talk about a very old story that continues to becoming more and more interesting. And this is about the spin 1/2 Heisenberg model with antiferromagnetic interactions on the Kagomer lattice. That's a two-dimensional Kagomer lattice. This is the simplest, like at least in when you look at it, the simplest possible Hamiltonian with isotropic interactions between nearest neighbor spins. Yet it has been studied for about 30 years with many, many different techniques. And although many aspects of the problem have been understood, I think the main, like the nature of the ground state and some other issues are still debated to date. And this Hamiltonian, this Hamiltonian might be realized in at least one material that was discovered about 10 years ago, the so-called Hebbertson tide. And so what we're going to talk about today is follow-up study that we did together with Yuan Wan and Oleg Chernyshov and Frederick Miller back a few years ago. It's about the resonating valence bond description of the problem, which now we believe at least conceptually offers the simplest microscopic picture that explains most of the established numerical results. And the outline of the talk is the following. I will just give a quick review of the spin S, general S, Kagome problem. Then I will move to spin 1/2 and outline the main and established results from different numerical techniques. Then I will discuss the microscopic resonating valence bond description of the problem and highlight why we have to consider the so-called virtual longer range singlet fluctuations and why these are important. And then I will compare with the established numerical results and show that at least conceptually you can get most of them within this description. Okay, so a quick review, spin S problem. If you start from the conceptually, at least from the large S limit, which is the so-called classical limit, and you do like a 1/S expansion, this is one of the first attempts to understand the problem for many years. Then, for example, at the classical level, you find that there is an exponentially large number of ground states, and there are infinite coplanar states and infinite non-coplanar states. If you include spin wave fluctuations at the harmonic level, you lift the degeneracy, but still you have infinite coplanar states. If you push the 1/S expansion to unharmonic level, then by now it's well understood that the so-called square root of 3 by square root of 3 magnetic long-range ordered state is selected. And we also know from various sources, numerical and analytical, that integer spin 1, for example, might be a very special case. Now moving to the quantum limit.
So what's the last paper? The paper by Locke?
This is where they showed that it's a valence bond crystal with this trimerized valence. Yeah. There are many others actually. I there are too many references here. So if I forget something, please tell me. Okay. So quantum spin 1/2 limit. What we know for sure, there is no magnetic long range order. This we know already from the early studies from exact dynamizations, for example, in the 90s. The nature of the ground state is still debated. There are three main kind of families of proposals. There is the valence bond solids. There is two competing spin liquids, the gapped Z2 topological spin liquid and the so-called U1 gapless critical spin liquid. And should highlight here with a different color that there is there is an early DMRG study started by the group of Steve White back in 2011. Showing that you have a good case for a Z2 gapped spin liquid. And now very recently, another DMRG study by Frank Polman and Oshikawa and so on, showing that if you actually consider longer cylinders and so on, you have evidence for gapless spin liquid. So still there is a debate already on the demergy side. There's other numerical techniques like the tensor network approaches that also show gapless spin liquid. Also variation Monte Carlo, for example, shows a gapless spin liquid. So there is still a controversy, a debate. So what we're going to ask here is, okay, at least can we identify what are the established numerical results? And do we have, or is it possible at least to, is there any simple microscopic picture, if any, to describe these results? And one of the first established facts was known very early from exact diagonalization studies. This is the so-called low-lying singlets. So what I'm showing here is taken from some of these papers from the Paris group, is that if you take, let's say, the triangular Heisenberg antiferromagnet, this is TAH, triangular lattice, and you take a finite cluster, and then you plot the energy spectrum as a function of the total spin of the cluster. The total spin of the cluster can go from zero up to the to n times 1/2, where n is the number of system size. Then you see this, and if you plot it with s times s plus 1, you see this very characteristic so-called tower of states, which is known from nuclear physics and so on. This is a rotational band kind of picture. This is the signature of translational and spin symmetry breaking in the thermodynamic limit. The idea is that as you increase the system size, the slope of this tower goes to zero. It goes like 1 over n. So if you have a flat manifold of states with different quantum spin number, then you can break the spin symmetry, right? If you make a linear combination with different s, it means that you break the spin symmetry. So this is how you identify that the for example, the 120 degree state in the triangular lattice. You have this characteristic tower well separated from higher energy excitations. And these are the spin waves. If you look at the Kagome, this KAH, you have a qualitative different picture. You have already below the first triplet gap, you have a very large number of singlets, a very dense spectrum, you have a lot of large number of triplets, and so on. There is clearly no clear separation of energy scales like this one here. And if you do a careful enumeration of the number of singlets that lie below this characteristic energy scale of the spin gap, you find that it's an extensive number in the system size. So there is clearly something going on here. And the ways to understand this, the three possible ways, that first of all, you can think of semi-classics, because, for example, you know that the triangular Heisenberg antiferromagnet has one ground state, so you should see one tower. But we also know that the Kagome has infinite ground states, so maybe you see many competing towers. And you just see a soup of all these towers of states. So this is one scenario. It actually turns out not to be true, as I'm going to show in the next slide. The second way to understand this low-lying singlets is the so-called trimerized limit, which I will not mention in detail. And then there is a natural setting in which to understand the origin of this singlet is the so-called resonating valence bond description of the problem, which I will come back to it later. So just one slide on why one way to see why this is not related to semi-classics. This is something that is very illuminating. And this is, for example, if you take the 12-side cluster Kagome, this is a so-called cube octahedron. And if you take the total spin, which goes from 0 to 6, and you can draw all the classical configurations that are coplanar on this cluster, and there are 24 of these classical configurations, and then you can ask how do these 24 different states decompose in terms of symmetry of the cluster. And these are the different irreducible representations of the symmetry, and you see, for example, for spin s equals 0, you should see one state, one singlet that belongs to the so-called A1G state. For spin 1, you should see 3 states because this EEG is twofold degenerate and so on. There is this table is taken from a group theory decomposition of the classical 24 states. And this is a prediction what you should see if the semi-classics is at low, semi-classical energies should appear at low energies. And then you see if you take spin 5/2 and you plot the energy minus the ground state energy as a function of the total spin, you see this out of, there are 10 irreducible representations in this symmetry group, in this particular one. There is the A1G, A2G, EG, and T2U. The remaining six irreps do not appear in this decomposition. And I use the red color for this. And you see that for 5/2, which is very classical, you see most,
seconds. So I didn't understand. So what is on your left column here, S?
And this is the total spin of the cluster, which goes from 0 up to 6, because this is 12 sites. This is the on-site spin. Yeah. And what you see here is that the very large energy scale from 0 up to 0.67, where you see only black representations. But not only this, you even can see that for singlet and for triplet and so on, you can actually match one-to-one all these rows. So this is really very, very nice, because it says that for at least for 5 half, semi-classics should work. If you do 3 half, still it's very good. If you go to 1 half, suddenly something dramatic happens. The red erupts take all over the place. So it means that qualitatively, the low energy spectrum of the spin 1 half problem is very different from the low energy spectrum of higher spin model. So low-lying singlets are not related to the semi-classics. So what are these low-lying singlets? They are really, they represent really disordered states that live, they have their own life in the singlet sector. And what is the nature of these disordered states? And what are the established results? What do we know about these states? So first of all, we know that the Z2 spin liquid is one of the competing states. This we know from the early DMRG. The physical picture of the Z2 spin liquid is in terms of the original one by Anderson, is that the wave function is a linear, a massive superposition of many nearest neighbor valence bond states, or at least short range valence bond states, where from one configuration to the next, you flip, you resonate between blue and red and so on. And these dimers are the singlets between nearest neighbors. And generally speaking, there are two ingredients for this type of ground state to occur. You need an infinite number of such nearest neighbor valence bond states to begin with that have low energy in a variational sense. And you also need a strong enough quantum mechanical tunneling between them so that you realize the resonance wave function. And there are two integrable quantum dimer models with exactly this type of ground state. One is done by Grégoire Misgish and collaborators in 2002. And a more recent one was done by Zhihao Hao and Iglis and Melko in 2014. And these are integrable models. The problem with these models is that they both, if you look at the parameters of the models, they appear to be very different from the parameters you get from the microscopic analysis. So how is it possible that that such a wave function is realized in this Kagome problem? There's some kind of complexity reduction in the problem, which I will try to highlight. Another competing state is the U1 Dirac spin liquid. The physical picture is that of fermions moving in the background of fluxes. The most recent DMRG study last year shows two things. One is that there is evidence for gapless U1 Dirac spin liquid. At least the excitations look like they have a dispersion of a Dirac spin liquid. And that would be consistent with the tensor network results and the variation Monte Carlo. But and this would be a first example of a gapless spin liquid in a non-bipartite two-dimensional lattice. And this is hard to get in the quantum dimer model setting that I will describe below. So that would be a very surprising result in its own right.
Actually, it's possible to get Dirac spin liquid from one dimer model. Basically, you generalize dimer models to monomer models. And you can show that it's actually can be mapped onto a U1D theory. There's a paper from Oleg 3 years back.
There is also one by Frank Polman last year, or this year, I think. But there you have the spin on energy should be very low, right? I mean, because here to have spinons live at very high energy scales in the microscopic model. So it's at least in conceptually, it's hard to imagine how, you know, we can discuss this in detail. I would like to discuss this in detail with you, yeah. So the second way to interpret this result, which is already discussed in the paper by Frank and so on, is that there is also a possibility that the model is not gapless. It just happens that you are very close to the quantum critical point with a singlet gap, which is much smaller than anticipated from the earlier 2011 DMRG results. And that means that you have very large correlation length, many competing states, and close to a critical point. So what other, besides these two spin liquids, what other types of disorder states have been established from the numerical side? Of course, there is the valence bond crystals. And the standard candidate from the valence bond crystal side is the crystal which has which maximizes the number of shortest tunneling resonances. And the shortest loop in this problem is the hexagon. So if you want to maximize to make this energy scale happy, you have to maximize the hexagons. And the way to do this is proposed for many years, is this so-called 36-site valence bond crystal. If you look at the 2011 results from DMRG, you see that this valence bond crystal has a very high energy. So this state is not one of the competing states. And that's a surprising result, because generally speaking, you expect that the shortest tunneling loop should give you the strongest tunneling amplitude. So it should be there at low energies, but we don't see it here. So there is a reason behind this, why the shortest tunneling loops do not play a big role. So next loop is the loop with length 8. And actually, this turns out to be one of the competing states, again, from the results of Jan Hus and White in 2011. This is a so-called diamond valence bond crystal, which kind of maximizes these diamonds, which are pretty much resonances between the two the nearest neighbor configurations around this loop 8. So the loop 8 resonance, for some reason, plays a much bigger role than the loop 6 resonance. So it has longer loop length, yet, and we know that at least quantum mechanically, the longer the loop, the more exponentially small is the tunneling amplitude. And here it does not work this way. And there is some fundamental reason behind this. And this is one of the stories that we had with Yuan Wan in 2014. And I'm going to mention this, why this happens. OK, so we have these established results. So what is the simplest? Is there a simplest microscopic description to explain these results? And I think at this point, what I will present today is, summarizes what we believe is one of these microscopic descriptions of all these established results. So we start with the RVB idea. The idea is that if you have two spins interacting antiferromagnetically at the classical level, you have up-down. If you put them on a lattice, which is not frustrated, you have up-down, up-down. Quantum mechanically, however, the system does not work up, does not want up down. It wants up down minus down up. That's a singlet. So the idea is maybe we don't want this configuration. We know this is the configuration in the end of the day, but just to set up the idea, is that maybe we don't want this. Maybe we want to form pairs of singlets to make the local on-site coupling happy, and then. Not all bonds will be satisfied. So the idea is that maybe if we from time to time we flip resonances from one bond to the other, maybe we can gain energy from these resonances and make up for the energy difference with the classical state. At the end of the day, the classical state wins on the square lattice, also on the triangular lattice, which was the case of Anderson in 73. And yeah, this resonance is the analog of the chemical bonding in benzene molecule. Okay, now there is we have to make a distinction between short-range valence bonds and short-range valence bonds. This is a short-range valence bond state, which is made only of short-range valence bonds. This is a state which has arbitrary long singlets. So this is called the long-range valence bond state. If we take this kind of states and we make linear combinations of these states, then what do you get? You get a long-range spin-spin correlations. At the end of the day, you will get a magnetic state. So if we really want a disordered magnetic state, we better combine this type of states. We make linear combinations of this type of states. And this should describe both valence bond crystals and spin liquids and so on. So what is now special about the Kagome is that the singlet of the shortest possible range, namely the nearest neighbor valence bonds, appear naturally at low energies. They just appear naturally. And this is what I will show here. And the reason is because of the property that is shared by corner sharing triangle antiferromagnets in general. And the idea is that you have the Hamiltonian. It's a sum over SISJ. You can, because it's corner sharing triangles, you can always rewrite this in terms of the total spin of a triangle square. Because this is square and J is positive, you not minimize the energy. You better make the spin of each triangle as minimal as possible. So if you take one isolated triangle and you diagonalize a three spin one half problem, you find two doublets and you find the quartet, spin three half, and the gap is a huge number, it's 3j over 2. Okay? If you now look at the wave functions of this manifold, They are made of nearest neighbor valence bonds, where you can put the valence bond here, here, or there, and the spin here, it can be up or down. This is a doublet. And now out of these six configurations, only four are linearly independent, and that's why you get two doublets here. So the idea is that this Hamiltonian is just the sum of the projectors onto this sector. So let's try to do this on the Kagomet. So we start like this. So far, every triangle is happy. Every triangle has a valence bond. So you satisfy the local energy everywhere. But if you continue to try to do this elsewhere, you soon hit a wall. You encounter the situation where some of the triangles cannot host a dimer. And these are the so-called defect triangles. These are the triangles that are not happy. And these are the triangles that will give rise to quantum fluctuations out of this manifold. And you continue like this, and there is other defect triangles. It turns out that there's, out of all the whole manifold of these nearest neighbor valence bond coverings, each of them has one quarter of the triangles is a defect triangle. So now the idea is that the defect triangles are not many, and we can qualify this later. So for this reason, this kind of states form a very good variational starting point. This is the idea why the NNVB states form an excellent starting variational point. And just to convince you, if you just compare with a state with at least one longer range singlet, you see you create one more defect triangle. One extra defect triangle costs a huge energy, which is 3J over 2. So this kind of states, at least on the variational level, they are very high up in energy. Of course, the interactions will mix the two manifolds. But at least to begin with, we can consider this manifold as an excellent starting variational point. And now you can also see why, at least in principle, you have the possibility to have a large number of low-lying singlets, and you have the possibility also to have a spin liquid to begin with, because you have an extensive number of such singlets are there to begin with on the variational basis. And actually, the defect triangles are the ones that mediate the resonances between the different NNVB states. So you have the two ingredients that are necessary, but not sufficient in principle, to get a spin liquid at the end of the day. OK, so how do we proceed on the technical level? You take the Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and then you take the NNVB basis, and you just project in that basis the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. The problem is that the basis is not orthonormal, so you have to reorthonormalize. This is this overlap matrix to minus 1/2. And the way to proceed is, you know, you take one NNVB state, which I call D naught, which is this configuration here, and then you get another one, D. The difference between the two is that they differ only around this loop here. Everywhere else they are the same, but around this loop, they have a different configuration, right? So now you ask the question, what is to find these matrix elements of this matrix here, you have to answer these two questions. What is the overlap between the two configurations, and what is the overlap of the Hamiltonian between these two configurations? And there are tricks how to do this. Let's go back to Sutherland 88 and Roxanne-Kivelson and so on. You just superimpose them, and then you do some tricks to calculate these numbers. Then you put, so you have the matrix elements of O, you have the matrix elements of H, and then you multiply the matrices and you get the numbers. Okay. Now the problem is that you have non-orthogonality. It means that all matrix elements of the Hamiltonian are finite in this basis, but they decay exponentially with the length of the loops in the overlap graph. This is the length of the loop in the overlap graph. So the idea is that to keep the most local processes, because these are the guys who will give you the most dominant effect. Okay, so what are the most local processes in this system? These are the processes around the hexagon. So you have a resonance between the blue configuration and the red configuration around the loop of length 6. This is the minimal loop. This is the so-called perfect hexagon process. And actually, you can think of this process as, you see, the blue configuration has three defect triangles sitting at these positions, and the red configuration has three defect triangles sitting at these different positions. So you can also think of this resonance as a resonance of three defect triangles from three positions to three new positions. Or you can also think it as resonance of dimers. Then there are the loop 8 configurations. There are three of them. And there is this diamond shape that will become important in the following. In the so-called diamond valence bond crystal. Then there is this asymmetric loop 8 configurations, B and C. Then there is the loop 10 configurations. Again, there are three possible resonances. There is A, B, and C. And then finally, there is the loop 12 configuration. And actually, this actually turns out to be not important, because if you look at it locally, at least, there is no defect triangle. So the Hamiltonian, if you apply the Hamiltonian on the blue, you get the blue. You don't get the red. There is no matrix element between the two. They are degenerate. So the tunneling matrix element is exactly zero, at least locally. So now the question is how to calculate the tunneling matrix elements of these processes. So again, we have to find the matrix elements of O, the matrix elements of H, and so on. The problem is that how to treat this minus minus 1/2. And there are, for many years, this was the biggest problem of the description, is how to treat this minus 1/2. Actually, it turns out that this problem is not the serious problem of this problem. It's not really the main problem of it, because it's mostly solved by now. So there is one treatment by goes under the name link cluster overlap expansion up to infinite order. It turns out that this is equivalent with the following construction. Let's say you want to calculate the tunneling between the blue configuration and the red configuration. This is a loop 6 resonance. So what you do, you take just this two by two manifold, and you calculate O, the matrix element of the overlap matrix element, the matrix elements of the Hamiltonian, and then you calculate the product of these 2x2 matrices, and then you get these numbers, and then you just extract the off-diagonal element, and this is your tunneling amplitude, which I will call NNVB tunneling. And in the following, this is I will call this the minimal NNVB construction. There is a general formula in terms of the matrix element V, which sits in the overlap matrix here, of E naught. This is the diagonal minus 9/4 here. Omega is the minus 1/4 here, and so on. This is a very general formula. What this formula tells you is that it drops exponentially with the length of the loop. This, if you analyze what V is and what omega is, and so on. And the second is that it contains absolutely no information about what sits outside the loop. You only look at the loop, right? It's 6 or 8 and so on, and then you get a number. There is no information about what happens around the loop. And this is the main problem of this approach, and I will come back to this. So if you look at the number, if you just take this recipe and you calculate the numbers, of course you will find that the loop 6 is the largest. In fact, the loop 6 is about more than 3 times larger than the loop 8. The loop 10 is similarly much smaller than loop 10. Sorry, loop 10 is much smaller than loop 8. And then loop 12, as I said already, is 0. If you just take these numbers, you look at this is more than 3 times larger. So the system would like to maximize these loops, these resonances. And as I said, this is this configuration, which maximizes this hexagon resonances. And I already said that this is not what happens according to DMRG. So something is missing from this traditional minimal NNVB construction. And actually, there is another problem with this construction. The problem is that the Z2 spin liquid appears very far in parameter space. So if you compare with the two integrable models, so these are the numbers I already told you. This is the tunneling. This is the potential energy term for each of the different loops. And these are the numbers I told you, minimal quantum dimer model. Now there is these two integrable models, number 1 and number 2, from Ms. Gish and Hao et al. So the first one is where you take all the potential terms equal to 0 and all the tunneling terms equal to minus 1. And you can actually show that the equal amplitude superposition of all NNVB states is an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian, because you always get minus 1, whatever sits there. And the other integrable model is by Zi Hao, is where you take everything 0 except the two loop 8 processes, that's minus, where you put T8 equal minus 1 and V8 equal 1. And actually, this goes under the more traditional Roxa-Kivelson construction, where you can rewrite this as a projector on the loop 8 process. And this is how you show that the equal amplitude superposition is also an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. For some reason, these two integrable models have exactly the same ground state. Okay, but now if you compare with the numbers of the minimal NNVB model, the microscopic model, they are very different, not only in the magnitudes, but also in the signs. Okay, And also this one is very different from this one. So again, something must be missing from the traditional approach. There is some complexity reduction that is going on that eventually will become visible at the end of the talk. Okay, so what is missing? What is missing is actually realized in 95 by Zeng and Elser in this seminal paper. What is missing is the tunneling corrections from virtual longer range singlets. If you just take the two loops that I showed earlier, the loop six the configuration that I showed earlier, and you apply the Hamiltonian, say here, you get this state where it has longer range singlets in the middle. So you have to include this excitation in the construction. You have to enlarge the NNVB basis to include the chi1. So this basis now, I call it NNVB plus. It includes the two NNVB states plus the longer range state. If you do the same kind of calculation, just having this 3x3 matrix, and then you end up with numbers which are different from the numbers of the minimal 2x2 model. But and actually, it becomes even worse. If you continue like this, you imagine now what happens if you embed the process on the Kagome. You imagine, for example, that there is a triangle sitting there and there is a singlet sitting there. Okay, and now if you apply again the Hamiltonian, you will get this type of configuration that I showed earlier, but you will also get these longer range singlets that go further away outside of the loop. And you can do again the calculation by hand or in Mathematica, for example. You will not be able to do it if you increase the embedding. Quickly, it will become impossible. But this already gives you the idea that, if you enlarge the NVB basis to include these fluctuations, you will get the exact number, and this exact number is different from the previous numbers, but also this number includes the renormalization from virtual excitations. And these are important because the differences, as I'm going to show, are very big. So virtual singlets, this is now another point, is that virtual singlets give rise to a dependence of the tunneling amplitude on the embedding. In other words, the quantum diamond model is not local. The tunneling amplitudes not only depend on the type of the loop, but you also have to check what is happening around the loop. For each different environment around the loop, you get a different answer for the tunneling. So you just hope that there is some kind of average tunneling amplitude, and then there is some little variation between different environments. And this actually, this turns out to be very important in the new developments that I will show later. Okay, so how to capture the dominant virtual corrections in a systematic way? This is what we did with Yuan Wan in this paper in 2014. You systematically enlarge the NVB plus basis, and you don't do it by hand because it's intractable by hand quickly. You do it on a numerical cluster level. You take a cluster, you do exact diagonalizations on a special design cluster, and you extract the tunneling amplitude from the Heisenberg spectrum of this cluster. So now how to do it, which clusters to consider, is you think of this, let's say, resonance on loop 10, and now this is here, you have a resonance between blue and red, and now you take the blue, for example, and you have a defect triangle sitting there. And now, if you apply the Hamiltonian on this side of the defect triangle, you generate this longer range singlet. If you apply now the Hamiltonian on this side of this defect triangle, the longer range singlet goes further away. If you continue like this, the longer range singlet goes further and further away. So time after time, after you're applying the Hamiltonian, you see you generate longer and longer range singlets. And this is now the picture is that, at least to the simplest, to the minimal approximation, is that these singlets, or you can also think of them as two spinons moving away from each other, they move along one-dimensional south to chains that emanate from the defect triangle that was sitting there in the beginning. Okay, so of course this type of construction works as long as we do not encounter another defect triangle nearby. So this is an approximation, and this is the first thing we did. Let's forget this assumption here. Let's forget that there are other defect triangles around. Let's just try to understand what happens at the minimal sawtooth chain construction away from the loops. So what did we do? We started with minimal clusters. So this is the different processes. This is loop 6, loop 8, and then loop 10. Then we start what we call the minimal classes, which are called R equals 0. And what you see is that each of these clusters has two NNVB states, and these are exactly the two NNVB states that resonate at from which we want to extract the tunneling amplitude. These clusters are specially designed so that the NNVB states are only two. And then you go to the next level, and you see wherever you have a defect triangle, you attach a piece of the delta chain. And then as soon as you go to the next level, then the delta chain becomes larger and larger. And then you check, the question is how to, for each of these clusters, so you start from minima clusters that accommodate only the two relevant NNVB states. You systematically enlarge the clusters to accommodate longer and longer virtual singlets. Then you extract the tunneling amplitudes from the exact Heisenberg spectra of these clusters. There is some certain things that go in this construction. You can check the paper. Then you check the convergence with R. It has to converge. Otherwise, this whole process is not working. And it does converge. And then if you think, if you want to consider, to think what this whole process is about, you consider the analogy of how to calculate the Heisenberg interaction from a two-site Hubbard model. You just diagonalize a two-site Hubbard model. This is similar here. We don't really want to solve the problem. We want to extract the microscopic tunneling amplitudes, and these are local processes that define these numbers. Yes?
Quick question. When you say that it should converge with R, you mean that the energy difference should...
No, the tunneling. So for each cluster, you get a number for T. Yes. Then you plot T as a function of R. And this is the next slide. So what comes out of this construction explains two of the main established results. It explains why the shortest loop is not relevant, and why the 36-site valence bond crystal has high energy. And also explains why Z2-spin liquid has to be nearby. And let's see why. So let's plot here the renormalized tunneling amplitudes as a function of R. So R here, so this is R equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. NNVB is the minimal 2x2 construction that I showed in the beginning. Then you see you have this huge number for T6, which is much larger than T8. And then you have much larger than T10, and T12 is 0. And now you as you increase R, you basically include further and further range corrections. And this is what happens for the loop 10. You get some renormalization, but quickly you get a convergence. For loop 8, you get some big renormalization, but very quickly you also get some kind of convergence. For loop 6, this is what happens. You have a huge reduction already at the R equal 1 level, which is more than 50%. So the relative ratio between 6 and 8 drops very quickly, well below 3 point something that was at this level here. So you have a huge renormalization. The loop 6 is, why is loop 6 affected so much compared to the other process? Because this process involves the maximum number of defect triangles. So it has the maximum locally, the maximum density of fluctuations. That's why it's renormalized so much. And now if you just take now the following, you forget all the parameters of the model, you just keep two parameters. You just keep T8 and T6, just the two dominant parameters of the model. And you forget the variations between the different types of 8 and the different types of 10. Different types of 8. I forget about 10. So I only have T6 and T8. And now this is results unpublished by Andreas Loechli. And what do they show here? They show that if you start from NNVB, this is 3.15, that's the initial ratio of T6 over T8, you are inside the so-called 36-site valence bond crystal. As soon as you go below 3 already, 3, which is a huge number, already at 3, you change qualitatively the physics. You go into a Z2-spin liquid. And why is it so sensitive to T6? Actually, there is a much deeper reason, and the reason is that there is a phase space argument. So if you take all the NNVB states and you ask the question, how often is it that I find a loop 6 resonance? The answer is that I find it 15 times less often than loop 8 and loop 10 and so on. So unless T6 is a huge number, it does not play any role. And apparently at the NNVB level, it was already too big. But as soon as you go 3, you enter a spin liquid. So T6 does not play really an important role. And this also shows why the Z2 spin liquid has to be there. This is not the end of the story, however. I did not answer why the spin liquid is there, right? This is numerical result. But why is it there? And the answer is given by Zhihao. Because the T8, what you're doing here, you increase T8. So the T8 model is one of the points in the spin liquid region of the phase diagram studied by Zhihao Hao and collaborators. Okay, so this is really the T8 equal 1 and V8 equal 0 point of the T8 V8 model of Hao. That's why the Z2 spin liquid is there. So you see already the complexity reduction. There is T8 becomes important for some reason that I explained, and you get closer to Z2 spin liquid. But this is not the end of the story.
Next question.
Yes.
Why M10 is equal to
You can show this by topological argument. Actually, you can enumerate. This comes from numerically enumerating this frequency, but it's like you can also think of it topologically. I think you can show it. Yes.
What was the reason for you to exclude the 10?
Just to simplify, I just took the two dominant terms.
Okay.
Right, and I ask what happens, because I see that T6 becomes much, much smaller than T8. So let's consider what happens at the level of T6 and T8, and then I will worry about T10 later.
Okay.
So this is not the end of the story, exactly for this reason, because I have not considered here the effect of loop 10. I have not considered here the variation between the different loop 8 and the different loop 10. Okay, so that's why it's not yet the end of the story. And I have also not considered the extra defect triangles that I mentioned earlier. Remember, these tunneling amplitudes are numbers that I get from a construction that I make an assumption there that I have this delta change, and delta, this assumption works as long as I do not hit an extra defect triangle as I propagate my singlets. But there is, of course, the possibility that you hit an extra defect triangle, and that defect triangle is nearby, and that will renormalize the tunneling. And this is what now we consider in this more recent work. And what I'm going to show is that this, if you take now this into account, then you can also explain most of the remaining established results. At least you give one microscopic picture for them. So what is the point? The point is that tunneling depends not only on the type of the loop, but also on the environment of the loop. So far, what I showed was that I just gave you a number for T8A, for example, but that number was just a number for 8A. I didn't tell you what is the environment of 8A. And that is important here, because depending on the environment, the propagation of these virtual singlets is different, right? So the tunneling should be affected by this environment. So consider now the most important events, which are the loop 8 events. There are three types, the 8A, the 8B, and the 8C. And what I showed earlier was this kind of construction where I was not worried about extra defect triangles. And now there is this possibility that right here next to the loop, there is an extra defect triangle. Or there is also this possibility that right here and here, there are two defect triangles. So this I call 0, 0, because there is no defect triangle here, no defect triangle there. Here I call 0, 1 because there is 0 and 1. And here I call 1, 1 because there is 1 and 1. So this is the minimal thing you can do, because otherwise it becomes very ugly quickly. Like you consider the closest possible environment, and these are these defect triangles. And this is what we did. And for the 8B, there is also again three possibilities, and 8C, there is also again three possibilities. Altogether, you get 9 parameters for loop 8. So the model becomes quickly, it has more parameters because you have to worry about the environment of the loop. But actually, this gives you the more insights, as we are going to see. If you consider the similar story for loop 10, quickly, you see that you get 29 more parameters. You have 29 possible environments for loop 10 altogether. If you include the loop 6 tunneling, so you have 2 plus 29 plus 9, 2 for loop 6 because you have T6 and V6. You have a model which has 40 parameters. This is crazy, right? So we started from a very simple model, and now we make it even more complicated. But actually, this kind of by including these parameters in our numerics turned out to be very important, because it gave us the right insights. And how to see these insights is, let's forget most of these parameters. Let's start again from the minimal model, which is just taking these parameters, the loop 8 parameters. So just to announce the result already, and then I will tell you how to present it. So the result is that if you consider the full model with all 40 parameters, you don't get a Z2 spin liquid. You get a diamond valence bond crystal, which is nevertheless close to the Z2 spin liquid, close to a critical point. So the result of this is that we don't get a spin liquid. We get a valence bond crystal, which is the diamond valence bond crystal found by DMRG in 2011.
Close in
parameter space that I will quantify in the next slide. So how to see this? The simplest way to see this is, actually you don't lose much, is you, out of these 40 parameters, you just keep the 9 parameters on the loop 8 side. Okay, so what do? We take the model by Hao. This is the model by Hao, but with V8 equal to 0. This is comma, by the way, not equal sign. So T8 is equal to minus 1 and V8 is equal to 0. This is one point inside the Z2 spin liquid phase of the phase diagram of that paper. And I call this model the T8 model because all the T8 loops have the same amplitude. There is no variation between different types of loops. There is nothing about the environment whatsoever. And now there is this model, the H prime, which is the numbers I gave in the previous slide, the 9 numbers. I didn't give you the numbers, but I can show you the numbers later. But this is the full model, but only without the loop 6 and without the loop 10. This is a simplified model with 9 parameters. And I put a number X here in order to interpolate between the Z2 spin liquid and what will be the diamond valence bond crystal.
So the difference between T8 and T8 prime is that in one case you take a different triangles and another you don't.
T8 is where you take all the T8s, all these T8s equal to minus 1.
So without taking into account different triangles.
Yes. And the T8 prime is when you take these differences between these different environments. Okay, so when you get exactly these parameters that we find from this construction. And now I put an X because I want to interpolate to see how close I am to the Z2 spin liquid and so on. And parameter X, what does it do? It encapsulates the effect of virtual singlets on the loop 8 resonances. Okay, this is a very simplified model. Out of the 40 parameters, I only keep 9. I claim that these are enough to understand the qualitative physics. And I will show later, I will comment on this. So these are the results. You calculate the ground state wave function on a finite cluster, here 108 sites of the quantum dimer model as a function of X. And you look at the dimer-dimer correlations. So X equals 0, this is a reference bond. And then you see dimer-dimer correlations decay very quickly as you move into the bulk. This is the spin liquid. This is not new because this is already shown by Zhihao Hao. Okay, now you take X equal 1. This is the model with the variations between the loop 8 processes. And then what do you get? You get precisely the diamond valence bond crystal. So black means positive, so full, and the different color, the orange is empty. So you can just look at the black, and this is a diamond valence bond crystal. Now let's look at the low energy spectra as a function of X. So this is 36 site cluster, this is 48 site cluster. This is the energy measured from the ground state energy. And then you see the ground state belongs to one topological sector, which we call 1-1. Then there is this excitation that is threefold degenerate. These are the three topological sectors, 0-0, 0-1, and 1-0. On a torus, you have four topological sectors. These are all four of them. So you have an excitation with a different winding number here. And then you have another excitation, which is this orange, which belongs to the finite K point of the Brillouin zone. This is the M point, the middle of the edge of the Brillouin zone. And this is now the way to diagnose the transition between the diamond, which happens at large enough X, and the spin liquid, which happens at small enough X. Okay, in the thermodynamic limit, you should see a degeneracy between different topological sectors. On this side, you should see a degeneracy between different K momenta that live on the same topological sector. And this is precisely the K point you expect for the diamond valence bond crystal. And you see there is some small variations with system size, but otherwise, and then all these gray levels are low-lying excitations that I will have the chance now to tell you in the next slide what they are. Okay, so this is a way to diagnose the transition looking at the low energy spectra. You can also do quantum Green function Monte Carlo because the simplified model has no sign problem. And you can go up to 324 sites here. And you can see for different values of x, so here is x equals 0, x equals 0.6, you can plot the topological gap. And then you can see a very nice scaling. There is 1 over square root of n here that is has disappeared. So this scale is like 1 over square root of n. And then you see there is for these values of x from 0 to 0.3, the extrapolation goes to negative. So this is the sign that you have a 0 topological gap in the thermodynamic limit. And above 0.3, you have a finite topological gap. So that's a sign that you are outside of the Z2 spin liquid. And here is the extrapolated values as a function of x. You see there is clearly an opening of the topological gap as soon as you enter the diamond valence bond crystal. So this.
Sorry, x equals 1 corresponds to the full model, right?
Yeah, this is way up, over here.
So since the full model is deep in the diamond.
Deep. So you now, to answer this question, you have to consider what x equal 1 means. So x equal 1 means 27 or 28% difference between the different loop 8 processes. So if you think about this number, and this is not very big. Right? So x equal 1 means a variation of 20 or 30% maximum between the important loop 8 processes. So this is the number you should think about. Okay. So this is a this is what is offered by this simplified model. A very clear picture. You have on one side you have the Z2 spin liquid, on the other hand you have a diamond valence bond crystal. These are the two of the main competing phases found by DMRG. So in that sense, this simplified picture should have a lot of physical content, at least at the level to explain these main competing phases. Now let's ask the question, what happens if you include the loop 10 and the T6 and V6. So T6 and V6, I think I already convinced you that it doesn't really play a role, even though T6 is still larger than T8. Okay, remember T6, as long as it goes below 3 times the loop 8, it doesn't really play a role. And we have explicit results showing this, yes?
Just before you go, sure.
Yes.
So in your picture, you want spin liquid, you not. And at all in this description.
Yeah.
This RVB description.
Yeah, this is in my last slide. So I think at the level of this quantum diamond model, this is a low energy microscopic theory. There is only the possibility that you sit very close to the critical point and you have like some kind of a gapless looking excitation spectrum. And that would be the simplest, more natural, most natural interpretation of the DM of variation Monte Carlo. Unless there is a U1 spin liquid in another direction in phase space, like nearby somewhere. Okay, so I was arguing that loop 6 and, do not play a role, but also loop 10, it actually qualitatively do not alter this result. The result is that if you include the loop 10, you also get the diamond valence bond crystal. In that means that the loop 10 is not big enough to drive you to another phase on its own. It's already much smaller than T8, but actually it shifts the transition to lower values. So this is something to mention. So loop 10, it comes with the opposite sign from T8. So if you remember the Mies-Gish model, all the signs are equal. They have the same sign. So if you put T10 opposite sign from T8, it frustrates the model. So that's why you get further away from the Z2 spin liquid. Okay, but nevertheless, qualitatively, this picture remains. So I think that at the end of the day, the question how far we are from the transition we cannot answer because we only consider the closest environment of the loop. So if you imagine now you include the further away, you have some other normalization that is like on the scale of 10% maybe, and that will probably change things also. But at least on the conceptual level, we have the main ingredients in the low energy theory, right? I think quantitatively you cannot answer how far we are. And now there is something very interesting. It's about excitations. There is one thing that we see in the numerics, one more thing, is that very low lying excitations. I already hinted that this is because you are very close to the critical point. But there is within the simplified model that I explained, there is a very natural way to see why you expect to have a very high density of low lying excitations and what these excitations look like. And here is the answer. If you take the diamond valence bond crystal, you can also draw a configuration which is a domain wall separating between different versions of the diamond valence bond crystal. So here you have one orientation of the diamonds, and here you have another orientation of the diamonds, and there is this green line separating the two regions. So now if you think at x equals zero, there is no difference between, there is no information about the extra defect triangles whatsoever. So the, at x equals zero, this domain wall costs zero, at least at the level of this model. Okay? Now if you increase x, then what you see here is that, for example, if you see this this shaded triangle, you can imagine, for example, this resonance here. Half of the time the diamonds hit here, and the other half of the time they sit here. When they sit here, this is a defect triangle. When they sit here, this is not a defect triangle. So half of the time there is a defect triangle there. So half of the time there is, you pay some energy. And this is the energy difference between one type of loop 8A and the other type of loop 8A. One has no extra defect triangles and the other has one extra defect triangle. So there is an energy cost which scales proportionally to x. Okay?
So this excitation becomes an extended object.
Yeah.
Like a closed loop.
Yeah, so on a torus or in a cylinder, you have to have even number of these domain walls. And now you can actually do much more. You can take three domains and merge them into one point. And here is this point here. And this is a so-called vortex excitation. You see there is a domain wall sitting here separating this orientation from this orientation. Then there is another domain wall here. So you use all three possible orientations of the domains and you merge them into one point. And you can think of this point as a Z3 vortex or something like this. Okay, and this actually, if you look at the energy cost of this excitation, it also scales proportional to x. The difference between this guy and this guy is that these guys appear they are sub-extensive in the number of sites, and these guys are extensive in the number of sites. So now the scenario is the following: that if the energy cost of both of these excitations is proportional to x, or grows with x, then as we go from the valence bond crystal towards the critical point, the energy cost of this excitation goes to zero. So this is the natural way to think of this transition from the valence bond crystal to the Z2 spin liquid as a condensation of this object. So and now the following question. Now, if the actual system is very close to the transition, but still on the valence bond crystal side, that means that we have a sub-extensive number of these excitations and an extensive number of these excitations that have accumulated at low energies and are prepared to condense. So this also has the virtue of explaining why you have a high density of low-lying singlets and what is the nature of this. And what is now very nice is that we have actually checked numerically by exact organizations on quantum Monte Carlo on different clusters, and we went through not just on the ground state, but also in the excitations, on many excitations, and actually you can actually probe that on many of these excitations you can see the diamond patterns. Not a uniform diamond pattern, but something scrambled, but you can really identify the diamonds. So definitely the diamonds are there, and this is like one way to think of this physics. Right. So that's the last slide. Basically, I think the resonating valence bond theory for many years had the trouble because it was very difficult to treat the problem of non-orthogonality, the overlap expansion and so on. Now it turns out by now we understand that this is not really the main problem. The main problem is how to treat the virtual singlets because these are really affecting the physics very much. We get a lot of, at the end of the day, I think this offers a very simple microscopic picture that accounts for at least most of the established results and offers new insights to the problem. For example, the high number of low-lying singlets, why the shortest resonance loops are irrelevant, the proximity to the diamond valence bond crystal, the proximity to the Z2 spin liquid. We cannot answer. I think it's pretty safe to say that we are on the valence bond crystal side, but I don't, and probably we are close, but we like to up to 30% or something. X equal 1 means 30%. But other than that, okay, then there is this open issue about the U1 spin liquid. So is this a nearby phase driven by some extra interaction that is that you can add there to the problem? Or is this related to critical point? For example, there is this, I don't think this is related here. There is this deconfined critical points where you have this emergent U1 and so on, but or you could also be the possibility that you have a dispersing domain wall states or dispersing vortex states and so on. This is like a very open question, how to understand this, the signatures of the Dirac kind of dispersion in, seen in the numerics. But this is kind of the one issue that we cannot account for at this point. And now there's a broader ramifications for disordered magnets. For example, we now understand that, you know, of course we can use the RVB theory in many different problems. The problem is how to technically take into account the valence bond, the longer range singlets. In the Kagome, it turns out to be more convenient because there is this construction, there is also the defect triangles that you can identify and so on. And if you take, for example, the J1, J2 model in the square lattice, I think it's more difficult to incorporate the effect of virtual singlets there. This is an open problem, but nevertheless, I think in principle it's doable. And for sure, the virtual singlets must play a very important role. And now actually there is one important one case, at least that we have studied 2 years ago, where you take, for example, a corner sharing triangle antiferromagnet, which has the shortest possible loop you can imagine. This is the length 4. And the next loop, it has length 6. And the ratio of the tunneling amplitudes between the two is 5 at the minimal NNVB level. It's not even 3, it's 5. That's a huge ratio. So you would expect the resonances of the on the squares to be the most important ones, because this is really a huge difference. And yet, the virtual singlets come into the game again and renormalize the loops for amplitude so much that they make them irrelevant. And what is happening at the end of the day, you get a valence bond crystal which maximizes the loop 6 and not the loop 4. So at least, I think this is one extreme example, and that's why we say it's fairly to say it's a universal example, that the shortest tunneling loops they are really irrelevant in most of the cases for most of the standard models. Yeah, thank you very much for your attention. Yes.
See, the defect triangle that we are talking about, it's a very interesting object in which the three spins are maximally uncorrelated. Because each one is...
The three half, the spin three half, yeah.
But also, you know, it could be in half also. Because since each one is what up as singlet
with some other, fellow,
you can imagine them to be independent essentially.
Yeah.
So I was wondering whether this becomes some kind of elementary object in the analysis. In other words, can I think of writing down an effective Hamiltonian?
In terms of the defect triangles, moving. Yeah, I think this goes along the lines of what Oleg Chernyshov did with Zhihao-Hao, where they thought of the defect triangles as bound states of kinks and anti-kinks. And there are some things you can do. Yeah, and I think they pushed it to the extent of these delta chains, but I think if you consider longer range loops, I think it becomes quickly, right, Johan? Quickly intractable.
So you can think of these defect triangles as bound states of a spinon.
Yeah.
So if you, so it turns out the defect triangles can be sort of, so each spinon can be sort of as a charge object, carries a fundamental charge. And so therefore, a defect triangle carries two fundamental charges. I'll give you two. So if you can go around, so there are bosons, and if you can go around, that means they condense, because it's a condensation of charge to object. So you end up with a Z2 spin liquid. So all these valence bound crystals can be sort of as some sort of crystal with this defect triangle. And also you can sort of unbind these defect triangles that turn them into really free spinons. Mm-hmm. Then you end up with essentially a Dirac spin liquid.
Mm-hmm. So there is some work done already by Oleg and collaborate.
Oleg has done some work along those lines.
Yeah.
So the low-lying singlets should not be thought of as loosely bound in the spinons. It's something more collective.
Yeah.
From what you are saying.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
The general question I have is, see, while this valence bond basis is very physically appealing because it takes care of singlets locally very nicely. It has this orthogonality problem, all these complications. How about going back to SZ basis?
Mm-hmm.
And there again, you know, you can imagine domain walls quantum fluctuating.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the SU2 symmetry will not be manifest.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any attempts to reconcile?
I'm not aware of such an approach.
Because
right.
If you think about a disorder, you know, take a snapshot of an RDBC.
Yeah.
It contains,
in terms of SZ basis,
lots of domain walls which are fluctuating. So those domain walls become physical objects.
Mm.
So somehow in this Kagome-Lattice, these domain walls are special.
Mm-hmm.
Some special character, which is, you know, taking you to closer to many, many phases. Anyway, I was just wondering.
Yeah.
More questions. Is there any indication that this Kagome-Lattice model is actually exactly integrable, but that we don't know the result? The sense it's a very special model and sitting at the critical point.
No, I think we are not at an integral point.
You don't think?
There are some integral points nearby at the level of XXZ. There are some recent papers, one paper at least. But I think this is already far from the Heisenberg point.
Nice.
Yeah.
The last question, what about chirality? Because chirality in granular lattice and so on, there are very strong fluctuations. So like if you deform, add some chirality term, chirality, I think, works, which says that you go into a chiral spin liquid.
Yeah, there is some paper by Frank Polman and Roderick Messner a few months back, right, where they added this term explicitly, and they even provided a low energy field theory for a U1 phase, I think.
So, because if anything, this U1 liquid should be close to the
right.
So you are saying there is no evidence for that.
At least at the level of the Heisenberg point, I don't see the gapless U1 possibility. I mean, but as you said, that could be nearby, like driven by a chiral term or like an explicit term in the Hamiltonian or J2 or chiral term. Yeah.
That's a nice question. So I don't know. Probably somebody considered Hubbard model on the Kagome-Lattice.
Mm-hmm.
And then in principle, you can change the ratio of the Hopping and U,
mm-hmm.
and basically to be close, deep to this Heisenberg model, or less deep, less close to this model. Can one learn something by?
Yeah, I don't know, but I can imagine already the large U limit is already complicated. If you go even to the mode transition, it becomes even more.
I think if you go away from this large U limit, then probably you can see how these processes which you
You mean like ring exchange processes and that are there to begin with in the original model,
The original model, how they would basically reflect on the this ratio of the T's which you were talking here. So maybe one can learn something from there about.
Yeah, I don't know whether these extra terms, what they want to do in this model.
See from the beginning, you have some dominating term and less dominating term, and then go on towards like very large U, which corresponds to this description.
Yeah, naturally, I think you would already at the simplest level, you could imagine that such terms would lift some degeneracies and would favor some kind of valence bond or, I don't know, but I'm not sure if this has been done actually. Yes.
So you mentioned that this full model, the full 8 model?
Yes.
That model has no sign problem, so you can do quantum Monte Carlo, right?
Yeah.
So can you actually estimate the correlation lengths for when S is 1?
So I'm not the expert that does the Monte Carlo here, but I've discussed this with Arnaud, and I think it's technically difficult. It's doable, but it requires some effort to calculate, to go on the other side to calculate the correlation length.
Right. I suppose the correlation length will give you some unbiased indication of how far you are from some critical point. point, right? I mean, presumably
at least at the level, you can already get this from the topological gap, right? I mean, you are suggesting to go also from this side and calculate the correlation length and see how, where it diverges. Or
right, so the x equals 1 is the full model. So I guess if it's really close to some phase boundary, no matter what that phase is, boundary is, it should have a very big correlation.
Right, so ideally, if we were to do this calculation, we should find a correlation length that diverges at this point, right?
I suppose.
From this side, but we have not done.
X equals 1 is already closed in some sense.
To gauge, you know, to quantify.
I just said, you know, using this parametrization in some sort of.
You're right. Yeah.
Coordinates itself, in a sense, is unbiased.
Yeah, actually, you're right. Actually, you can already see, you can already see the gap closing on this side here in low energy spectra, and then you can see that it doesn't close very fast. But this is already an indication, as you said, that maybe. Or the correlation length is large all the way up to x equal 1.
Right. So then you can compare this length with typical DMRG sizes.
Right. That's a good suggestion. Yeah. But we discussed this, and maybe we should revisit this.
Is it diffusive Monte Carlo?
Green function Monte Carlo.
Okay. Yeah. That's basically
diffusive. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So you're. This is sort of expansion in the tunneling from your calculations. You have the shortest, the second shortest, and third shortest all being the same word.
Mm-hmm.
Is given that, can you have some idea when this loop expansion should take over again? Like it should actually start decreasing, or is it possible that it just breaks down completely, going to larger and larger loop size?
You are asking if I were to increase R.
No. Like if you go to 14 centers.
When you say comparable magnitude, this is not completely true, because if you really look, because you know the scale is not helping here. If you zoom in on this energy scale, then you see, for example, the loop 8 is of the order of 0.08, the loop 10 is of the order of 0.045. So there's a difference of like more than 20% or something between 10 and 8.
So is it still following some exponential scaling like you'd expect?
We didn't really put it on the curve, but for sure it's not exponential. We know this.
But for example, like the six site loop, it's, you can easily, and I don't know, it doesn't look like it's converged in any real sense.
Yeah, I forgot to mention this. Actually, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Because already the thing happens here from between R0 and R equal 1, we know that T6 becomes irrelevant. So of course, it probably will converge at some point. Actually, we don't care what the converged value will be, because we also have done the results with T6 and without T6. And if you can look at the spectra, I don't know if I have them, and see that there are really not differences in the spectra. Yeah, I don't have. I can show you right next. I have them in the paper.
The higher loops, you expect it to decrease sharply.
Yeah, I mean already at the. Yeah, this is a general trend. So if you here, you have to start from these values here. These values already drop exponentially, and then these values here are even smaller than these values anyway. So if you already know that the loop 14 is like one hundredth. Of loop 8, then if you include the renormalization, it will still be like 1 over 200 or something, you know.
Is that something like it always goes down? Is that?
Yeah, so at least these numbers here.
Okay.
Yeah, qualitatively, you can also expect that these guys also go down, because the more environment you include, the more fluctuations you add, it means the more weight goes to longer range singlets. So the tunneling between the NVB singlets goes effectively down. That's why, of course, there are some things like here, but these are, you should not compare this number here with this number, because this is altogether not the R equal minus one. Okay, this is like a very, that's why we use the dashed line here. This is really a very different projection. So it generally goes down, yeah. Yeah, for sure, loop 14 and so on, you can really forget them. Already the physics is around the hexagon.
Short question about where is Weisan excitation? Is it there or
on the liquid side?
Yeah.
It should be there, yeah. I only discussed. Yeah, it has to be gapped. The gap should go to zero at the transition, I guess. That's the other way to see the transition to the from the other side, coming from the other side.
Okay.
Right. So coming from this side, the gap, the Weisan gap should go to zero. And coming from that side, correlation length goes up, and then the gap of these vortex states and so on goes to
what
zero.
What I'm asking is, in the numerical, you see a singlet or a proliferating singlet, are some of them Weissonic, soft Weissonic?
Yeah, but it's very hard to identify them, I guess. You can do a variational calculation. You can construct such states variationally and check what happens to them.
Just from
this has been done for on the triangular lattice, I think, or like some years ago. But and we actually discussed this with Arnaud. I think this is possible to repeat on this at the level of this model also. But that's like yeah.
We have no other question.
Thank you.